to The Tipping Point. We are now officially in a Thursday afternoon here on 90.7 FM, KALX Berkeley. Time, as tradition dictates, for another edition of Arts and Review. My name is Gregor Sharpen.
And I'm Stephanie Kalem, sitting on a wobbly stool today, so there might be a crash.
But you've got your feet firmly planted on the ground.
For once.
We are going to be here for the next half hour talking about a show which is happening up at Port Costa. Which, if nothing else, that should be the attraction alone, to go up to Port Costa to see, just to see Port Costa, kind of.
Yeah.
The show itself is about Port Costa. It's called Port Stories, and we have with us in the studio today the director, Rebecca Longworth, and one of the actors, Lee Rondon Davis. Thank you so much for coming in and relinquishing your afternoon to come and talk with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
I think maybe we should just start by talking about Port Costa. For people who are unfamiliar with it, it's a very strange, kind of out-of-the-way little community, and certainly does seem rife for theatrical exploration, let's say. So let's talk about the initial impulse for the show and what the research process was like.
Okay, I'll start. This is Rebecca, and Port Costa is fascinating. We actually, Lee and I were speaking this weekend about how it seems that about half the people we talk to say, "Where's that? Never heard of it." And the other half are like, "I love that place." There's about 200 people that live there. It's right under the Carquinez Bridge. So it's kind of like right in the middle of the Bay Area, but no one really knows about it. And
the people in Port Costa like it that way.
Yeah. They don't mind that at all. It's a quirky little place. There's a lot of art happening there, a lot of artists, more visual artists than performing artists, although lots of music. So a collaborator of ours actually happened to be born there, has some family that still lives there, and through various connections in that way, our company, Idiot String, has actually performed there with our touring shows about once a year, once a summer. And about a year and a half ago, were invited by the Port Costa Conservation Society, which is a community group, to be more active there and create some work. And so this is our first big creation in the city, town.
Yeah, I was one of those people that didn't know anything about Port Costa. I mean, I've lived in the Bay Area for 16 years now, and yeah, they were like, "We're going to do the show in Port Costa." And I was like, "Who? What? Where?"
Is that on the Embarcadero? Is that right?
I have no idea. And then that's what I was kind of thinking. I was like, okay, kind of cool.
Yeah. I think there is a brewery.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a Port Costa brewery. I think somebody was mentioning it. Yeah. I think Joan.
I don't know where, but somewhere.
Yeah. But
more research. Time for more research.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so kind of getting brought on to this project, I learned a little bit more about it. And then being there, our first time there, we were like, what is this place? And there's the being port accosted is a term that we use. And the like neighbors are like, "Who are you, stranger? Tell me more about yourself." And they kind of in a very kind way, kind of antagonize you a little bit in a ways that you're not familiar with. And they're like, "Who are all these strangers? Get them out of rid of town, you weird artists." And that was kind of our first introduction for those of us that hadn't been there. But they've been super welcoming. And there's so much history there that I learned about through this process.
Were you brought in before the script was kind of set? I mean, were you part of the research process, or at what point did you enter the process?
Pretty early on. So we all kind of identified roles that we would like to fill within the process. So I was brought on as a creator and performer. So we didn't have a script when we started. We did about three, four months of workshops where we would spend a weekend up in Port Costa and do some devising, some theater games, bonding things, but also figuring out what we wanted this story and journey to actually be. And so that was a pretty fun time. And then my character, Cass, leads the audience from the historic schoolhouse through downtown, through the town, into the major downtown area. And my monologue, basically, I'm just talking nonstop for about 5-10 minutes as we lead the folks downtown, and I learned all of this history just through the monologue. That
so you kind of serve as the docent for Port mm-hmm. Stories.
Yes, yeah. I was like, I am a glorified tour guide, and I'm okay with this. Yeah.
You have actually, that's one of the hardest jobs in this show, because, so I fall into the group of people who loves Port Costa. I discovered it not long after I moved to the Bay Area in like 2001, and I was part of the group, a certain subset of Bay Areans who would like rent a bunch of rooms at the Burlington when it was really cheap and, you know, kind of wild, and, you know, go to the Warehouse Cafe across the street. And it was like this great little like party staycation. And then the only other things I ever did there was, now there's a Port Costa townwide yard sale. Yes. And I have actually helped out at a wedding at the Port Costa School, because it's also Sweet. A wedding venue. But the town itself, like, that Port Accosted thing is so real. And, and you know, the idea of you having to herd us like ducklings down that road while all these people are coming out of their like funky little eccentric houses and looking at all these funky eccentric people and going, what are you doing? And then when you get down to the warehouse, like, I mean, to the main drag, keeping us in line and then sort of shunting us off with characters, like, it was pretty masterful. I mean, I feel like you have the hardest job in the show while still being like the most low-key character.
Yeah.
Well, you also get to play one character, which is not the case for anybody else in the show.
Yeah, that was the advantage. There are no insane costume changes in a car or like in a back room at the Burlington Hotel. They're like, my fellow actors and performers are doing some hard work.
Yeah, there's a lot of running around that you don't quite see when you're an audience member. There's some like behind the scenes, like sprinting. And...
Well, there's even some in front of the scenes sprinting.
Well, that's true too. Yeah. There's
the character who we see sort of trying to get into the house, and then as we're being hurtled along, jamming down the street to get there in front of us.
Yeah, that's Solimar,
who when we saw it, actually got hooted and hollered at from some people hanging out outside the Burlington. Yeah, she's like drunkenly trying to get into the Warehouse Cafe, and there's a bunch of bikers yelling at her, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" I was like, yeah. So we should mention that this is an immersive theater experience.
Yes.
In case that was not obvious.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, I love it. Love it, because there's like people that have no idea that like a show is coming down the street towards them. Yeah. And everyone that finds that out is like really delighted, and that's also exciting. So the bikers, I learned later, not only did they like hoot and holler at Solimar across the street, but then Charlot, who's the silent filmmaker, was about to do a scene right next to them. And right before her scene, explained to them, like, okay, here's what's going on. And then they got really into like watching and having her do slapstick in front of them. And like, so they got kind of a free show, and we love that.
Well, there was, I mean, also we were with the In the Little Garden scene, and we had to pause every now and again for this go by the street.
Oh yeah, that's
then,
an earthquake.
And then a couple more lines. Biker earthquake.
Yeah. Yes, totally.
So how did you, what was the distillation process to get to the characters that you got? I mean, you do go through a variety of time periods, and there's several mm-hmm. time periods kind of active at one time. How far back into the history did you go? What were the ones that you looked at and thought, that'd be great, but we can't do that? I mean, what was
that?
Oh,
so many.
So many.
Do you want to speak to that a little? Or?
Well, yeah. So Cass, we decided would be a contemporary character and kind of stay that way throughout. And for me personally, it was because I felt like it would be really important if we had a Black queer character in the show, that to address like what that meant for them in a past time. There's a lot of weight, but mm-hmm. a lot of the other actors drew from their own family members, their own family histories, in order to create their character. So Kenny Scott drew from his great-grandfather, Oscar, who he found out was a train hopper, ended up in the Bay Area or somewhere nearby in California.
I'm actually really sorry I wasn't able to follow that thread more.
Yeah. You gotta come back. You just gotta come back. Yeah. But he did all this research and talked to a bunch of his family members and like learned all these really weird parts of this family history. Some of it we were able to include, and some of it we decided to leave out, the more scandalous bits. But, the play would have been 3 hours long as opposed to. But yeah, it was great kind of figuring out those things and what we want to include, and also what what is the context and what is the impact of having different folks of different, you know, sexual identities, gender identities, going being back in time? And mm-hmm. how do we incorporate that, or can we even incorporate that? And
yeah.
that was a lot of the process.
And there was a lot, also obviously a lot missing, too. So I guess the way we sort of started the process was everybody learning a bit about the history of Port Costa, which definitely includes train hopping, it includes shipping and dock working, and a lot of, like, migration and immigration, and also segregation within that. And then also talking about our own, like, family histories of migration specifically, like how did we sort of all get to where we are and what does that mean? And then where's the overlap and like what are the like pieces that resonate and what do we want to draw from and what do we want to dig deeper into? It happens that we have no Asian American actors in the cast. So that's a huge piece that's missing is like the Bay Area has a very rich history of Asian American immigration and migration. It's from the very beginning of non-native people living here. And our stage manager is part Asian and has was responsible for including a little bit of Asian American story in the postcards that you might find in the, and it's like, it's heartbreaking that that's the only thing that's there right now. So, you know, were we to do this again or expand it, we would want to really like draw in and be sure we're like very representative of more, you know, kind of covering everything that's there in the Bay Area. But there's so much that we drew from and then so much we had to set aside and leave for another time.
Yeah, save for Port Stories 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Exactly. Yeah.
Could not resist.
I mean, one of the things about the show is that it rewards attention to detail. I mean, as we were leaving the school, I noticed there was a little drawing of a Selkie on the wall of Isla.
Yeah.
You know, a little sort of
Isla.
Like, you know,
yeah,
Isla. This is my family heritage, and I'm going to draw a drawing of it and put it up on the wall in the school.
Yeah.
And it's not drawn attention to. But if you happen to notice it as you're walking past, it has a resonance there.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And actually, that is one thing I wanted to talk about, is that the mythologies are a big thing in the show, sort of the competing mythologies and competing, cultural heritages that are expressed through mythologies.
Yeah.
And the Selkie was one that I immediately clicked to, and I wasn't as familiar with some of the other mythologies, but let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, and some are entirely fictional. So, yeah.
That's why I'm not familiar
yeah.
with
it. So,
Chupatieras?
Yeah, chupatieras are something that we made up. Based a little bit on chupacabras, but and how, you know, parents might use that as a, like, you know, keeping the kid in line, watch out, don't misbehave, or someone will come and get you, kind of boogeyman style. So there's all these different mythologies of, like, what's causing the earthquake, and not specifically causing the earthquake. I shouldn't say causing, but, like, strange things happen after the earthquake in this town. Like, people find stuff, or they receive messages. And for Isla, who has a Celtic background, she believes that that's like spirits coming through different times. And she also firmly believes that her aunt was a Selkie, which is a mythology that has existed for generations in the, I guess, like the British Isles and up there and Ireland and North Atlantic. Then there's a character whose mythology is basically drawn from Marvel movies and The Flash, and it is firm in the belief that, like, some Flash-like character has been running really fast through cracks in time caused by the earthquake to leave toys and other stuff and fix things that went wrong. And some people are just like, well, I don't know what happens, but I get a toy after an earthquake and I can't explain it. Yeah.
I want to ask a little bit about that, the interactive piece of it, because I know afterwards when we're all kind of standing around, I overheard you, Rebecca, mention something about Sleep No More to one of the patrons. I know. And so I've seen Sleep No More. I've also been to the speakeasy. One of the things I really liked about Port Stories was that those two shows have like enormous production value. And this show has Port Costa.
Totally, yeah.
Which I think is perfect because of all the things we've already talked about. But also, the interaction is pretty solidly in the middle of those two shows, like because in Sleep No More there's no talking and there's a lot of rules and you're basically just there to witness and maybe explore the production value, the production, like the set. And then in Speakeasy, like sometimes the we've talked to some Speakeasy folks here. Sometimes the actors can be, you know, I don't want to say aggressive, but insistent. If you saying no doesn't necessarily ward them off.
And you get drawn into little rooms, like you get grabbed by the arm and pulled over here.
Or invited in, but still. Yeah. So yeah, so I guess I'm just curious about how you guys decided to draw that line. Like, is it something that, you know, are there ground rules that you set for the production when you were developing it, or is it something that you have to be really nimble about? Like, how does that work for you as an actor and you as a director?
Well, I'll start as a director because I have very strong feelings about this. But one of our biggest drivers in creating work is really to activate connection between people and authentic connection between people. And how, you know, we're always looking at how can we do that in a way that isn't threatening or uncomfortable or is like, and is always with the consent of everybody involved. So that's really important to us. And Sleep No More is a really exciting piece, and I will never make a piece with people in masks because that means that there's no connection. So, and you know, they put the audience in masks and that puts them in an observer role. But I'm really interested in having them in a more interactive role. So for me, that's like a guidepost, right? And then having that invitation that also an audience member could say no to is really important to me because that can be scary for an audience member. They don't know what the trajectory is. They don't know kind of what they're in for, and they won't even import stories, but we're also hoping to allow them a little more agency in terms of like, where are they going to go? Are they going to say yes? Are they going to say no? And we're also feeling it out as we go too. You know, we have these like ideas of what we want it to be, and we've set it up as much as we can to do that. And then in the moment, you kind of never know what you're going to get, which Lee could probably talk to a little more.
Yeah. I mean, like Rebecca said, I think like consent and both actor and audience comfort were really, really important for us. So we had a lot of conversations about, for one, the actors, like how do we protect ourselves and take care of our own boundaries, and using different techniques from different organizations in order to like address those things and be able to say, no, I'm not comfortable with that, or like, no, you need to listen, this is for your safety, things like that. And it's interesting because we kind of had to create our own language and process for that, because a lot of those things are, you know, de-escalation techniques for dealing with people in crisis as opposed to dealing with audience members in an immersive theater piece.
Yeah, just possibly
audience in crisis.
Yeah. So thankfully there have been no crisis, but we've only had three performances so far.
Here at Berkeley, we have a major called Peace and Conflict Studies. I feel like this is applicable.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just the three shows we had last weekend, it kind of ran the gamut.
Oh, like, completely different audiences. Yeah.
Yeah. At each show, like between 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. on Saturday, you know, that's not a huge chunk of time. Totally different people coming in. There's a point at the end where we ask people to exchange stories written on postcards, and one woman stands up and she's like, I'd like to share my story. And I had to like kind of on the fly be like, well, that's somebody else's, so maybe don't share it. Save it for yourself. I don't know if that person wants it read aloud, but I really appreciate your enthusiasm. And like, let's move on to the next part of the play. And it's not to shut her down or, you know, this is our play. We're the only people allowed to talk. That's definitely not the case. But also being aware of like other audience members' comfort. And for myself and my mom in particular, I thought about her this whole process. It's like, my mom's not going to want to do that. Like, she's not going to do that.
I think that because that happened before the show that we saw. So I think you've sort of added in a few lines in the postcard instructions. Be respectful of these people's stories.
Yep. Save them. Treasure them. They're other people's stories, not yours.
Not yours.
The person that Greg passed his postcard to had tried to give it back to you.
Yeah.
He was like, do you want this? I don't want this. I was like, oh, it's nice, Greg. It's a nice moment.
Well, and everybody reacts differently. Yeah. And we also want to be really aware that people are going to enjoy something differently. Mm-hmm. Like your mom, for example, might really love just watching. And then somebody else might like really want to be the person that gets handed something to read, you know. Yeah. So people have different ways of engaging.
Yeah. And this has been kind of like I've done a lot of theater. I work for a number of theater companies. And this is the first time where I've had to do so much kind of thinking on the fly of like, okay, I see that person's really not into that, or like this person's really excited. Like, what can I do to get people more engaged? So I know Oscar has a great moment. He's like, you guys want to roll a cigarette? You want a sip of this whiskey? Like, those, that's great for the people that really want to engage with the actors, whereas...
Of the appropriate age.
Oh, yes. Not everybody gets a sip of whiskey. But, you know, and then there are some people who are a little bit more talking-based and, like, movement or, like, singing a song. Some folks got to help Solimar write a song.
We did that.
Yeah.
Oh, it was great. I kind of forced you to?
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. And so, like, that's a learning thing for us, is trying to gauge who wants to go where, who wants to meet someone else, who will be more comfortable in different situations. And I get the most time kind of getting to know the audience and seeing what everybody's about.
It's also
stressful.
Interesting because I mean, certain groups, I mean, that when we were in the garden, I think there were maybe like six of us in the garden. And being in an audience of six is a different experience of being in an audience of two,
yeah,
or being in an audience of one. I don't think there's any ones in this show.
Not purposefully.
Not purposefully.
But not usually.
I mean, so it's interesting, kind of an audience experience can be sort of accordioned according to like how many other audience members are there. So that's another interesting sort of dynamic to try and, like, again, think on your fly and sort of be nimble on your feet.
Yeah, and we're really excited about allowing the audience to have that opportunity to have a more intimate interaction, and, you know, somewhat depends on the size of the overall audience. But yeah, you might get down to two people and an actor, which could be exciting.
I have to ask, because I'm looking at the clock and I know we're starting to run out of time, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask, in all your research into the history of Port Costa, can you say, was the Burlington really a bordello?
I cannot say. And in fact, signs point to no.
I thought that was way too perfect.
Yeah, signs point to no. Well, and there's some really interesting reasons. First of all, it's very much like on the main street, but also not on the former main street. So the former main street was actually the wharf, which has burned. And, well, it was destroyed in various ways at various times and rebuilt once, I think. But that was, like, right where the shipping really sort of came in. And so, you know, you'd put a bordello a little closer to the sailors, but also not quite on the main street. And this is a fancy building for whatever time period. So most likely not a bordello.
I would love to know when that started, because all the rooms are named after women.
Yes.
And everybody always says, oh, they're named after the woman who used to live here, used to work here. So yeah, somebody had a genius / problematic marketing
story.
Concept some decades ago.
Yeah. On the other hand, I can definitely say that it's haunted.
Oh,
I mean, that's
good.
Clear.
Okay.
We're staying there next weekend. That's
it's
Rebecca.
Fine.
Okay.
Oh, it's fine.
So you'll find out.
Ivy's the best room.
Okay. Good to know.
Ivy, good to know.
My favorite is Hortense.
I think it's just like the ones that have like a window on the wharf and a bathroom. That's what I remember about Ivy.
We are unfortunately running out of time. We should mention the specifics once again. Port Stories is happening up at Port Costa, running through...
June 30th, we just announced an extension.
All right.
Saturdays and Sundays, right?
Yep.
Three shows a weekend?
Saturdays 1 and 5, and then Sundays at 5 o'clock.
That's right.
And everyone gathers at the schoolhouse.
They do.
Yes.
For people who are interested in finding out more information, websites, contact information.
Idiotstring.org.
Rebecca Longworth, who is the director of Port Stories, and Lee Rondon Davis, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thank you.
This is the Program Arts and Review here on 90.7 FM, KELX Berkeley. I'm Gregory Sharpen.
And I'm Stephanie Kalem.
And coming up in just a few minutes will be Penny Royal to take you up until 3 o'clock.
Yay.
Speaking of songs that happen in the show, here's this.
The apple. Whistling song, concluding another Arts in Review. My name is Penny Royal, and this is Calix 90.7 FM.